welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt that you are seeing amount to a higher and higher, to this insurmountable number, that is all unconstitutional. So we've got Tammy Young back with us, and welcome back, Tammy.
Thank you.
And I really appreciate your willingness and patience in doing all of this, because bottom line, just doing it by myself, it just becomes a monologue. And you're reading, you're asking questions, your affirmations, what have you. It really is priceless. So anyways, folks, we were going through, we're still going through the Constitution. We've cleared Article 1, Section 8. Now we just started off in Article 1, Section 9. And what we covered yesterday was the, actually, wasn't yesterday, it was last week. And what we covered was the migration and importation of persons. And again, I cannot emphasize enough that the government, the only time government in America had the authority and power to go and bring lots of people here, and it was only granted to the states within this Constitution, only the states had that power, and they only had that power for 20 years. After that, we went to a one-by-one, case-by-case immigration process where people would immigrate to the states and eventually the federal government, because of other problems and what have you. And technically, they should have amended the Constitution when it came to immigration, because they had the responsibility of the naturalization process. But as we started having, you know, problems with people going abroad and coming back, and as I will just say, as the world got more evil and access in and out of countries with airplanes and everything else became more prevalent, the need for managing people, because the federal government does have this responsibility of anybody coming into the United States. So bottom line, I think it's not a huge egregious violation that they're managing the ports of entry. But the fact is that they do not have the authority to bring in large groups of people, you know, under some umbrella of refugee or anything like that. So the next one that we're going to go into is subsection. Well, actually, you don't have these by subsection, but I'm going to call each paragraph as a subsection. And so this next one of the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus, that's subsection 2. So go ahead and let's read that.
Okay. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it.
Okay, so the federal government is constrained to not be able to suspend the writ of habeas corpus. But where is this constraint? This is in Article 1. So this means that the responsibility of declaring and affirming the writ of habeas corpus is limited to Congress. Only Congress can suspend it. The president cannot. Folks, I have these conversations all the time. When Lincoln started suspending it, when Lincoln declared martial law, he overreached. I mean, that was a huge violation of the separations of power. He began acting like our king. He was the antithesis of a president under this Constitution. And therefore, he assumed all sorts of power. He used all sorts of tyranny. And literally, he ruled by an iron fist. Even in his day, he didn't have a velvet glove. You know, today, you know, most regimes like Russia or China, they rule with an iron fist, but they wear a velvet glove. So everybody looks at it and goes, well, I'm not too intimidated by that. But I'm telling you, you get hit by the iron fist, whether it's got a velvet glove or not, it is going to decimate you, right? I mean, anyway, so this right here is basically keeping them from being able to just capture you, arrest you, or suspend you. And as a matter of fact, this was clarified in the ratification debates that they could only suspend habeas corpus when the militia has been deployed. So to be clear, what are the two things that are tied to this? Unless when in cases of rebellion, in other words, an insurrection, that's going back up into Article 1, Section 8, subsection of what, 14, right? I'm pretty sure it's 14, mm-hmm. where the Congress shall have the power to provide for calling forth the militia to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, or repel invasions. So they're tying this directly to that clause. So when they have to deploy, then they are granted this right here, the ability to suspend. This is fundamentally martial law. So when you go into the ratification base, which we just covered, Paul and I just covered this a couple of months ago, when you look at the ratification debates in Virginia on June 14th, go get them, folks. Go read these things, and you'll find on June 14th, they talk about the parameters of what it takes to allow Congress to declare martial law. In other words, they can only, this is how it was defined, they could only declare martial law to the area where the militia is deployed and only while they're deployed. So they can't declare it before they get deployed. They can only declare it once they get deployed there and while they're deployed in that area. What that means is there is no carte blanche of power or ability to declare martial law throughout the entire United States. So what happened with Lincoln is he declared martial law without the authority because he's not Congress. He actually dismissed Congress and said, I'm the king now and I'm going to have all discretion. I'm going to do what's necessary. So therefore, he declared martial law, and supposedly people say, oh, well, we're still under martial law. Bush declared martial law. Bush didn't have the authority to do that. Did they deploy the militia? No, they did not. Folks, understanding the Constitution is critical because how it was defined in the ratification debates is the only way it can be executed and the only way they can operate by those standards and stipulations. So the next one, subparagraph or subsection 3, is a short one.
No bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed.
Okay, so a bill of attainder is a bill that basically, it's a capital offense that goes after a certain class of people. A bill of attainder or punishment. Technically, the spirit behind this is that the government cannot go after classes of people. So, in other words, the Jim Crow laws, because you were black, you couldn't sit where these other people sat at the counter and in these booths or in this specific railroad car. You had to sit in, you know, an inferior railroad car. And then this concept of separate but equal was created on the Plessy v. Ferguson in the later 1800s, and this concept of separate but equal is equally unconstitutional. Every person has the exact same privileges and immunities. If you're the first person getting on the train and it's open seating, then you can sit anywhere. When they come to you and say, we have a law that keeps you from sitting here, that becomes a bill of attainder or punishment, where you're punishing a class of people. Let me give you a modern day example of how bills of attainder and punishments have been applied just recently. They've created bills of punishment. If you don't have a vaccine, you can't travel. If you don't have a vaccine, you can't come into these public spaces. When states started passing laws like that, that was a bill of punishment. Because if you're not going to be compliant with, you know, injecting yourself with this harmful crap that we want to kill you with, then we're going to punish you and we're going to inflict this punishment upon you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I mean, wouldn't it be the same for masks as well?
Masks are the same thing, yes. So that would be more of an ex post facto law because they mandated that on everybody. It was just a certain class of people, right? So an ex post facto law is if it was legal and legitimate for you to walk around without a mask, all of a sudden they pass a law and say you have to wear a mask now. and we're going to come after you, cite you, we're going to punish you if you don't wear a mask. That's technically an ex post facto law. A good example of an ex post facto law in today's world, because this is what they've done, is in an ex post facto law, many people have bought property that had, you know, no running water on it. And the basically, when you're way out, like where you live in Wyoming, if you don't have water, you have to do what to get water? You have to dig a well, or you have to spend a lot of money in running a line to get the services of public water. And that is almost untenable. I mean, you probably have to dig further, miles and miles and miles, to extend in such a rural area like Wyoming, where, voila, you're going to have a well. It only makes sense to get a well. So what they've done in many states is they passed laws. In Washington State, the Hearst decision was one of those things where they violated the Constitution and said, if you do not have a well on your property at this point in time, you cannot put a well on it. In other words, you just bought that land 10 years ago. You plan on retiring and building your home there and everything else. And now they say you can't have a well. They just made your land worthless to you.
Mm.
And that is...
Why would they do that?
Why? Because they're trying to force people from living in the very rural areas and developing. This is the Agenda 21 or Agenda 2030, whatever, the next new version of this globalist laws and policies they want to inflict upon America to force us into cities and to force us in their control. But bottom line, folks, these are ex post facto laws. You bought that property, well waters were legitimate and legal. Let's say you had a water capture system. You had a water capture system and you were capturing all your rainwater and it was going into basically a barrels or into a well or a container, and you were using that water capture system to irrigate your crops for the year because maybe you had a really good rain season, but in the summertime it was always really dry. So, you know, you had to have some kind of water. So instead of using what little water you have coming out of your well or what have you, you could create this system. Many states have created laws that say you cannot have a rain capture system anymore. The fact that they've even done that,
that's ridiculous.
Well, so this is ridiculous in two realms. First, it's an ex post facto law. And secondly, they can't tell you how you have to run and, you know, operate on your property. The only power your state has over those things enumerated. In other words, if they don't have anything in there to tell private citizens how to operate, you can't have a capture system. They have to actually put that in the Constitution to be able to control a citizen's property rights. In other words, right, we've lost sight of the fact that it's your property. You can do with it what you want. The fact is, when they've gotten these HOAs, it's one thing to move into an HOA because you don't want to live in a community where people are free to paint their house pink and do all sorts of crazy things. I understand that. And so if you're all willing to abide by that, but doggone it, if somebody really wants to paint their house pink or yellow or whatever, bright chartreuse, whatever, it doesn't matter. That's their property. And just because they signed a contract that says they'll abide by living in this community to do this, there is no allowance in America where a person can be conscripted. We'll get into this in Article 4 and actually later on in the amendments. You cannot become a slave to a contract where you lose your property rights and your individual privileges and immunities. It's almost like having an HOA that says, oh, you can't possess a gun. You cannot store a gun in your home. That's how ludicrous these HOAs are, but nobody ever places context to it. But the fact is, an HOA cannot function with the restrictions that they have created in America. Like it or not, folks, no state can make or enforce any law that abridges your privileges and immunities guaranteed by the Constitution. In other words, your property rights, they can't make any law or enforce any law. So if all of a sudden your HOA is coming along and saying, you got chickens, you can't have chickens. It's clear in the covenants.
I was just going to say, does that mean we can all have chickens?
Yes. Yes, you can. So let me back up. It's one thing to be able to say you have property rights and you can do that, but not all property is equal, and so property rights aren't necessarily equal. What if you live in a condo, you know, and you're living in town and you have no yard because your condo has no yard? Can you have chickens then? Well, I think it's reasonable for government to create health and safety laws because local government needs to do that. So it's one thing for them to say, if you have no property or if you don't have this much property for a chicken coop and enough, you know, air between the chicken coop and your fence and your neighbor's property, then if you don't have these minimum standards, then you shouldn't have chickens. Okay, that makes sense, doesn't it?
I guess so.
Right? I mean, would you want to live in that apartment where the guy down the hall or above you has 50 pig sows, you know, in his apartment, and these pigs are just, I mean, all he did was he bought this apartment and he moved the pigs in there. He lives somewhere else. And that's his property now. So he's literally raising pigs above you because he doesn't have a yard and you don't have a yard. And you know all of the excrements are, you know, going to start coming through your ceiling, and you're going, hold on here. Does he really have a right to do this?
That's true, but they could use that same argument with people with actual property, with the yard.
So it's a health hazard, so this is where we have to govern ourselves, and we have to actually look at, is that reasonable? And so this is where we hope reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. But bottom line, when we create a government, when we institute a government, it has to be done through a constitution where we delegate power. If you've got a city that has a charter, you've got a city that has not been instituted by the people. You've got a city that was instituted by your state. Your state should not have that authority. If it's in the state constitution, then you need to remove that, because we, the people, institute our governments. And that state government was not instituted by itself. It was instituted by the counties. And so this is one of the reasons why understanding constitutions and understanding the important role that we, the people, have in framing them, so that we actually start with our local government and be cognizant in the next layer to create a general government, where that general government cannot step upon the rights of the people at the local level. So in other words, if you do live in an area and you like a county or a township, and the township says you can't have chickens, they can't just do that. They have to have a clear delineation of justification, and you actually have to empower them that with that constitution. 9 times out of 10, the people will say, well, we do want you to have health and safety standards. And then the people will basically gauge on whether it's excessive or not. And they'll say, you know what, we deem what we gave you as excessive. So now what you're doing based on what we gave you is excessive. So now we got to go in and we got to amend that to make sure that you can't do these things. One of the things we have to be very cognizant of, because this is a problem in the state of Washington. The state of Washington actually tried to pass a bill, and I think it failed, fortunately, but many Republicans were supporting this. They wanted to create a law that required any government, whether it's local, county, or state, that you could not create any tax without the approval of the people. In other words, what they're doing is they're creating, sorry about that, what they're doing is they're creating a democracy, because if the people have to create the taxation, when we create a Republican form of government, we delegate those powers of taxation to our government, to your county, to your city, to the state. And what we need to do is just make sure that they only are using those methodologies that we've delegated, understanding the Constitution and framing them so that government can do what it needs to do and nothing more. And when we actually say, well, we the people want to do this, then what we've done is we've set aside our Republican form of government, where the people are now creating law. We can't and should not do that. This is where we actually start actually using, when the people have their hands on the public purse, next thing you know, there's cake for everybody and benefits for everybody, because everybody wants what we would call a safety net. Everybody wants to have this assurance that if something bad happens to them, that they won't be hurt bad. But as soon as people realize that you've got this safety net that creates a really good quality of life, then why work? In other words, safety nets only entice bad behavior. This is the same thing as when we spend money to remove the consequences of sin. All it does is it entices your actions to be more sinful. I mean, why not do it? Why not go and drink if they're going to give you a brand new liver? Why not, you know, and a brand new brain? All the things that are the consequences of that, don't worry, you know, we're going to cover you with health care. We're going to take care of that. That is when government becomes and does the work that is literally evil. So.
Agreed.
All right. So the next one is no capitation, just subsection 4.
No capitation or other direct tax shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken.
Right. So when we read the 16th Amendment, guess what? That pink part. Oh, by the way, most all of these things are being violated, folks. Almost all of Section 8 and most all of Section 9 is being violated. But this is pink. In other words, pink means that the no capitation or direct tax shall be laid, period, or comma. That right there is a direct violation, and the 16th Amendment is the vehicle that is violating that. Because when you read the 16th Amendment, it only addressed Article 1, Section 8. It did not allow this to happen. It didn't undo this. When you read the language of the amendment was really only changing the apportionment tax and changing all of those parts. They didn't see this. This goes to show, when we start looking at some of the progressive amendments, these guys went down this path of creating these amendments, but they were completely ignorant to all the things in the Constitution. So they were only going after these few things and didn't realize there were a few hooks that were also there that they had to address to legitimately create that constitutional amendment. In other words, when you create an amendment and that amendment actually violates other parts, you're changing one part of the Constitution, but there are other parts in the Constitution that are integral. If you don't know that, then you're creating an amendment that violates the Constitution itself.
Well, I'd also read that the 16th Amendment was never actually properly ratified either.
Well, so right, wrong, or indifferent, we've been living with that amendment, but they've been misinterpreting it, and there are problems with it. Yeah. So here's the thing, because we need to focus on getting constitutional compliance. And there are groups out there that their whole focus is stopping the direct tax. Technically, the federal government, based on Article 1, they do have the ability of direct tax. That direct tax was based on apportionment and census, like it says right there. And so when they stopped that and they said, we're going to change this to income, then bottom line, in doing that one thing, they changed that to say, instead of taxing the states by apportionment and, you know, just sending the tax to the state legislature, we're going to tax direct tax to the people and their income. There were so many problems with that amendment, it actually should have been thrown out. Bottom line, they say it was ratified and they started implementing. And just the fact that they created the IRS, help me out here. When they created the IRS, we're going to go into a break. Was that constitutional? Remember, who is supposed to execute the laws of the union? So when they created their own police force of taxation, tell me if that wasn't a violation. We'll be right back after this short promo. So I'll let you everybody ponder on that. And Tammy, you can answer that question when we come back. We'll be right back after this. Thank you so much. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so, ding, time's up. So, when we look at this, help me out here. So when we're looking at whether they can do this or not, what do you say? What's your response?
I would say no.
Okay, so why?
Because it says no direct taxation.
Okay, so when the... No, but we're talking about the existence of the IRS.
Oh, the IRS.
Yeah. Right, so they went off, they created this income tax, and they went off and created the IRS, right?
Yeah.
So that's how they started collecting taxation. Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 14 states that only Congress has the power to execute, to call forth the militia to execute the laws. So did the 16th Amendment change that part of the Constitution?
No, absolutely not.
It didn't. As a matter of fact, it may state that Congress shall have the power to create legislation to enforce this. That only means that they can create the regulations of enforcement, but it doesn't change who executes the law. The only entity that has the authority to actually execute anything from the federal government is we the people. When you start understanding that right there, that is the ultimate check on tyranny. Are you going to actually draw your guns and go around to your neighbors and do something stupid like, say, we got to kill your dog, you know, or anything that's an outright violation of the Constitution? No. This is the ultimate check. I mean... We talk about checks and balances and separations of power, these beautiful things about this Constitution, but nobody, it's hard for people to fathom that we actually have this ultimate check. Okay, so there you go. Most people think that all these federal enforcement agencies are legitimate and the money that they're spending to do it. No, we're supposed to do that. So technically, where should that money be spent on the enforcement of that law? It actually goes to the militia and to the people of that state that are out there executing the law, instead of creating this bureaucracy and then start basically aggrandizing their power and aggrandizing, you know, these benefits for these special people that now are above the rest of us. You see how it creates classes?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. So the next one is also interesting. Subsection 5 is what?
No tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state.
In other words, if you're going to ship a product from your state, then it says no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. Now, let's just say that the state of Washington chopped down a bunch of trees and it went over to a lumber mill and created lumber, and part of it went over to a paper mill and we created paper. Now that product actually goes out from this state into your state. Can you lay a tax on that lumber and on that paper? If you go to the store, is there a tax ever associated to your purchasing of lumber and or paper?
And it says no.
Well, it says no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. What they did was they just created the sales tax. When you go to the lumber store, do you pay a sales tax? When you go to the, you know, Walmart or any store where you buy office supplies, do you pay a sales tax?
Yeah, of course.
That means that everything that's coming in from another state and that the state is actually adding a tax to feed themselves, it is in direct violation of, actually, hold on here. To be clear, this is a taxation on the federal government. So this is restrictions on that. But when we get down into Section 10, you'll notice that the same thing applies, that they can't create taxes or duties on anything that is comes from one state to another. In other words, the way government has gotten to empower themselves is through money. And they've tried to figure out ways like property tax and sales tax and so forth. This is one of the reasons why they had poll taxes. So poll tax is the same thing as a property tax. Ah, but it's not mandatory. A poll tax is something that if you want to have your say in government, you got to pay your taxes on your property. Now, I believe it was accumulative. I believe the way they did it in those days, it was accumulative. If you didn't pay your taxes over the course of a couple of years or what have you, they'd say, okay, you haven't paid taxes for 3 years. This is what you owe. And now you can go vote. In other words, you actually had to pay for access to be able to have say in your government. And it what that did was it created classes where people that could vote and people that couldn't vote. And the people with property, and so if, just look at it this way. Because the people with property were protected, most everybody was being protected. Because if a property owner actually had this ability to actually create a taxation on, and they, you know, they created rent and so forth, but rent was a free market. In other words, if one person was charging this and there were lots of people that needed it based on supply and demand, the rent would go up. If there was an excess of supply but no demand, rent would go down. So the market, the free market principles usually drive the prices. But when they start injecting and start controlling the amount of houses, the amount of property to protect renters or so forth, then government is putting its finger on the scale of a market space to help those people who are basically paying and providing. But getting back to poll taxes. When you look at a poll tax, if you didn't pay your poll tax, and I don't know if they were completely accumulative over your life or over a certain span, it may have been a 4-year span. I would love to look this up and see how they did it. It was different from state to state. The fact is this, that if you wanted to have say in who was in government, you had to pay a poll tax. And so many people that had land, and you got to remember the government was constrained to only those powers delegated. So you were just making sure that your guy was going in there, and the hope was that they would maintain, you know, within their respect of those powers delegated. But what ended up happening was people started buying favors and so forth, and this is how money crept in. But because it was this, not a game, but there was this threshold that kept people from just, you know, if you want to have say, if you're not happy with your government, you got to pay a poll tax to change it. And so most people, for the most part, were pretty happy. And it took a long time for things to really get so bad. But before that happened, they already had other mechanisms of taxing and so forth that they started doing to you. My point is this, is that if we went back to a really limited defined government and we went back to a mechanism of taxation for your state, how would your state actually, what would be the best way of taxing? Taxing property is antithetical to what we would call this free, you know, your property is yours. Government's responsibility is to protect your property. So if they can start levying taxes on it, that means they can take your property, right?
Right.
So what would be the best mechanism for, because if they start adding sales tax, that means that they're taxing all things that are coming in. It's one thing to tax goods in the state, but it's not good to tax stuff that's going into the market space because it starts having an effect, a bad effect towards certain types of products where let's just say the lumber that's being made and harvested in Wyoming would be more expensive than the lumber harvested in the state of Washington because there's a greater abundance, there's more people, they got an economy of scale, they could probably do it much cheaper and ship it to you cheaper. So when you start creating protections and these types of taxes, you play this game instead of using the free market to actually allow things to flow, and you start levying taxes and literally manipulating the market through taxation, then things start getting out of control or things start going sideways. My point is that when we look at how governments operate, what is the best way of taxation?
I don't know the answer to that.
Ah.
What is the best way?
Well, so they were able to actually tax, and what they did was they made sure that the state could tax on production. I honestly think that probably the best way to do it is to figure out what your government needs to function to do their job. And then you figure out, okay, so we need this much money. How can you do that without actually creating a bad condition where government takes property, where government, you know, affects, you know, essential items? Like most people find that the taxation on food is repugnant because food is essential.
Yeah.
And so you can play these types of games, but actually the best way to figure out your best taxation is to determine what government really needs. Because once you know that number, then you can say, because government shouldn't have rainy day funds. It's nice. You know, it's nice for households. Rainy day funds should actually be silos of food, you know, tanks and tanks of energy or fuel, the things that are essential for the economy and the people to live and function. That should be not a pile of cash, because, see, when you have a pile of cash but you have no food, how good is that cash?
Yeah.
If all of a sudden you're hit with a famine, you know, it doesn't matter how much cash you have. It's just not enough because there's no food. And it's the same thing with fuel. If all of a sudden there's a complete loss of food. So when we look at the CCC and how the federal government started creating these national reserves, they use those as weapons. But the state should actually say, if we're going to have a rainy day fund, we have no business doing that. And we need to constrain the government to say, look, it's one thing that you create, like Pharaoh, you know, silos of food, because during a famine, we need to be fed. During, you know, a lack of energy, we need to keep the things going. So government should have, you know, I would say reserves, but reserves that actually serve the people, not government. And so the money doesn't serve people. The food will serve people. These are the essential things, because we all know that's what's coming. We're going to have a famine. We all know that access to things, we already saw this with the pandemic. So why aren't we taking the corrective actions now? They're not. And the reason they're not is because their paradigm is based on direct taxation and spending money on, you know, and everything is just going up. And, you know, we need to actually break these paradigms. So back to the best taxation to me, I think it would be best to have a taxation on income based on the needs of the state. So in other words, it would fluctuate. If all of a sudden the state didn't need as much money, they should actually reduce your tax. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I don't know how that would ever happen because the state is never honest. So
right. Well, so that's the only reason states aren't honest is because they're not transparent and they're not constitutional. the parties and everybody else are colluding in the state is the all powerful corporation. This is a corporate form of government. I mean, technically, we live in a republic that has a corporate form of government. We live in a republic that has a party form of government. We live in a republic that has a judiciary form of government. We live in a republic that has, I mean, we have every form of government except for a Republican form of government. A Republican form of government is a self-governing system. That means you have to be involved. The committees that are making the decisions should be at the county level where the people are contributing. And oh, by the way, if you're contributing into self-governing system, that you're sitting on an infrastructure committee, you're sitting on a, you know, commerce committee, whatever these committees that you think are essential that you need to guide government, if the guidance should come from the people and you aren't compensated. Government should be, I'm absolutely okay with getting away from the paradigm of where government is making money, they have retirements and so forth. We need to make it so that it becomes far more, less self-serving and far more everybody required, public service and so forth. People say that when you actually go down that path, it just, you know, too many cans in the kitchen, too many cooks in the kitchen, whatever. I don't think so. And I honestly think that when the people actually are brought to the table to actually get engaged in what are the best solutions, this is how we have a better government. This is how we actually have... Go ahead. I'm sorry.
So you're saying first figure out what the basic needs of the government are to function, and then you think that the best taxation would be based on income-based?
Well, so I'd say the best... Absolutely, the best taxation probably would be income, but it would be a flat income. So in other words, you basically look on how much revenue the people, businesses, and everybody else is making. You can tax businesses, but as far as I'm concerned, when you tax businesses, that's a double tax on the people, yeah. Right? And so, you know, when you have rich people that don't claim income, then they try to play that game. Well, you can't allow games to be played. You know, and you can actually look at taxing wealth. You know, you can go down those paths, but, you know, we need to make sure that it's a fair system. And I honestly look that when you really examine it and how it's to be done, there's an argument for poll taxes. There is an argument for poll taxes because whatever the poll, whatever it costs for government, for your, if you want to play, you want to be involved, boom, this is what it's going to cost for everybody. Bottom line, you know, they tried to make it, and that's what they did. The poll tax was greater based on your property value. When you go through the Constitutional Convention, they were literally talking about assessments and using assessments for establishing the taxes, but taxes weren't compulsory. Taxes were voluntary. And so the more you had, the more onerous it was. But that means that you may have more interest in being involved. But it's still a flat rate. So let's say for every dollar of value your property is, because let's say certain property has a higher value, right? If you're living on the top of the mountain with a beautiful view and it's only 1 acre, well, that value of that property based on the demand or the market or whatever would probably be higher. You know, I'm only rattling off all of the different things that would be on this table. But I believe that through diligence, prayer, humility, and everything else, you get the people at the table to say what is the best way. 9 times out of 10, reasonable people, equally informed, seldom disagree. Then they will find their way to saying this is the best way. The problem has been government has never been going to the people. They've been doing it themselves, and they go into these dark rooms. They say, let's do this. And they start rubbing their grubby mitts and going, wow, this is a way we can start, you know, making our own retirement, and we can do this. And they have been serving themselves instead of you. And the only way we can do this is by a self-governing system where we all participate in the process. We have to. If we're not... then we don't have a self-government system, and then we start quickly going down the path of a land of princes and princesses, you know, dukes and duchesses, and, you know, this monarchy, because they're the ones that are going to rule you, an aristocracy, so to speak. And we can't allow that. We have to have to maintain our liberty and our freedom. There comes with a price, and that price is your time, your efforts, your energy to contribute to your self-governing system. You have to do it, whether that be jury duty, whether that be committee duty. That's what I honestly believe. If you're in a committee in one of these infrastructure at the county level, then you shouldn't have to serve on jury duty. But everybody, what would happen is everybody would be ratcheted involved. And, you know, the people that don't want to sit on jury duty, boy, I think it's really appealing to sit on that health care committee. If you're going to have health care in your county, you're going to get involved in that, okay, because that's what you want at your county. Doesn't mean the state's going to do it, but your county. You live in a really progressive, and we want to provide health care because we're really rich. And let's see how long that lasts. They're going to create this system, and all of a sudden it'll collapse if they try to give away too much that they can't carry. But they can't share that with other counties in the state. You own it. You have to self-sustain. If all of a sudden you go bankrupt, then you go bankrupt and start over again. And then the people will probably less likely to go down that path of bankruptcy. This is how we learn.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but when we got a government that keeps printing money and throwing it out there, this is how we have this illegitimate trillions and trillions of dollars of debt. So, back to Article 1, Section 9. No preference. Now, this is one of my favorites. Go ahead.
No preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another, nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, or pay duties in another.
Okay, so no preference shall be given. Now, the spirit of this, because they felt that the federal government could influence things by providing preference to say, anything that we need, we want to send it into this port. Therefore, rewarding that port and punishing the other ports because they don't get the business.
Right.
Shipping is a huge business. And as a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons why the Chinese started trying to monopolize the shipping world. And that's one of the reasons why Amazon today is trying to monopolize shipping in America. They realized how much they were spending, and they figured, well, I will tell you that Amazon may be doing their own deliveries now. They finally moved up and grew out of abusing the U.S. Postal Service. But now they're positioning themselves. I believe that they will probably try to take on American Express, where you, if you're an Amazon member, you can actually not only buy things from Amazon, but now you can ship anything to anybody and receive things from anybody using Amazon delivery. You see this? You can you not see this coming down the path of Amazon growing and doing this? Because that's exactly what they're doing. They're buying this fleet of a bunch of small trucks and creating, they're creating their own postal system. But guess what? We're going to get here. Actually, we already read it. The federal government has the authority to establish post offices and post roads. The fact that Amazon is doing this and undercutting is actually antithetical to the Constitution. Yeah, so when we actually look at out of all, everybody loves this delivery system. The fact is we should have fixed the existing system that we had instead of allowing this free markets to actually come in, compete, and actually cost, bring up our overall cost of shipping, because that was profit-based. That started lining people's pockets. If we understand public utilities and public services, we actually have to give what is necessary, but everybody wants to be chintzy. Look at what it costs to send a letter. It's a buck. You want to send a letter with FedEx, or you want to send a letter with the UPS or Amazon. I mean, that costs you $150 just to be a Prime member. And then whatever the cost of, or what have you, I have no idea what they're going to do, but it's less to go with UPS than it is with FedEx or anybody else to send a basic letter to pay a bill. Why? Because the cost is marginal. It's more marginalized, or I should say the economy of scale is in play here. But there may be other shortfalls, and we may need to actually re-examine the Postal Service. But the fact is, the Postal Service isn't even owned and operated by the federal government anymore, and they had no authority to do what they did in selling it off. That is a constitutional responsibility. Huh. The only way they can get out of not providing postal services and post office is to actually amend the Constitution. Say we're going to get rid of this. We're going to sell it off, and we're going to amend the Constitution that we don't do this. Yeah. So anyway, when regards to this preference, though, I think what really needs to be highlighted is the fact that the federal government, the spirit of this whole thing was they had very limited and defined things, that they couldn't create these preferences. And when they go down this path of immigration, they have no ability to create a preference for the people on our southern border from anybody else who wants to immigrate here in the world. And they're allowing a preference to be given. Well, if because you live there, we're going to let you come in. Every nation in the world should be suing the U.S. government on preferential treatment because they're allowing these people in and they're keeping everybody else out. Bottom line, we have a standard. We have measures of immigration. There's only so many people that are allowed in here a year. And the fact that they're just opening up, I mean, they are literally waging a cultural war by using this open border policy.
Yep, kid.
So, anyway, seven.
No money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law. And a regular statement and account of receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time.
Okay, so no money shall be drawn from the treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made. In other words, they can't spend a penny unless they actually create a law on it. They can't create a law unless what?
Congress meets and makes a law.
Well, yeah, Congress has to do it, but we haven't even gotten to the Supremacy Clause. All laws that are in pursuance to this Constitution are laws. Anything that is not in pursuance, in other words, when they create a law of welfare, of Medicare, or pharmacy aid, or what have you, is it enumerated in the Constitution?
No.
Then when they print money or spend money, they're literally violating Article 1, Section 9. Because it is not law. It is not based upon the enumerated objects within the Constitution. They're, in other words, it's fraud. They're creating an expenditure on something they have no authority to spend. It's like giving, you know, your checkbook for your business to somebody that just wants to become a philanthropist and give all the business money away in any way they possibly can. And times out of 10, they use that as a weapon for themselves and your enemy. And that's exactly what they're doing. Go ahead.
So with that, you're saying that we don't owe that debt either.
No, we don't. And as a matter of fact, we just ran out of time. And so with that, folks, we'll be back tomorrow and we'll be going into the last subsection of Article 1, Section 9. And then we dive into Article 1, Section 10, the restrictions that the Constitution has against the states. So I'm hoping this is helping you understand the immensity of the violations. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.